Freunde vorstellen. Leslie Curtis studierte Romanistik und Literaturwissenschaft an der University of North Carolina sowie an der Universität de Pau-Valéry in Montpellier und dem Institut d'études françaises in Avignon und auch am Middlebury College. Sie konnte bereits wertvolle Erfahrungen durch ihre Unterrichtstätigkeit in französischer Sprache, diverse Tätigkeiten als Tutorin, Fellowships und durch mehrere Konferenzbeiträge in den USA sammeln. Derzeit absolviert sie ein Doktoratsstudium an der Duke University in den USA zum feministischen Abolitionismus-Engagement. Das Thema ihres heutigen Vortrags ist Samor Emirsa, Sklaverei auf der Bühne, der dramatische Abolitionismus von Olympe de Gouges. Und sie wird ihren Vortrag auf Englisch halten.
Ich kann nur ein bisschen Deutsch sprechen, so I'm going to present in English. I have quotes in French, and thanks to Victoria, I've translated them into German, so hopefully among the three languages we'll understand each other. In February of 1790, less than a year after French revolutionaries wrote the Declaration of the Rights of Man, Jean-Baptiste Monneron, the brother of a slave trader from Nantes, defended the slave trade in front of the National Assembly. He explained to the assembly that, quote, what is good and just in the conscience of a father does not always work when one governs a large empire. The moral of a man of state should be in numbers, end quote. Besides, he argued, those who believed that the French trade in Africans was cruel were mistaken. Slaves were treated avec douceur et humanité, with gentleness and humanity. Monneron congratulated the authors of the Declaration for writing an enlightening document. He warned them, however, that its ideas should be reserved only for the French. Monneron tried to convince his audience to maintain the slave trade in two apparently contradictory ways. He declared that it was not really that bad to enslave Africans, and even if it was, making money was more important than assuming the ideals of the Declaration to be universal. Monneron's words did not fall on deaf ears. According to Laurent Dubois' research on the Haitian Revolution, in the summer of 1789, slaves were turned away at French ports for fear that they might be exposed to ideas that would be dangerous to the stability of colonial rule. In April of 1790, so just a few years after, after Monneron's speech, all mail from France addressed to slaves or mulattoes in the colony was redirected to the municipality. As the revolution grew, so did anxiety about the future stability of the French Empire. Yet this anxiety had been growing throughout the 1780s. Tens of thousands of Africans were disembarked off ships on the coast of Saint-Domingue each year, and Saint-Domingue was the name of the colony that would become Haiti in 1804. In the decade preceding the French and Haitian revolutions, slave mortality was at its highest rate. Late 18th century inhabitants of Saint-Domingue felt that their colony could erupt into violence at any moment. In 1784 and 1785, the king issued reforms to the Code Noir that, although not well received by slave owners, were designed to alleviate tension in the colony. And the Code Noir was the set of laws regarding slavery that had been in place for 100 years.
Code Noir?
Yes. These reforms made the king a central figure in abolitionist arguments because he was understood as a power who could oppose the cruelty of slave masters. A little-known and rare woman playwright named Olympe de Gouges submitted a feminist and abolitionist play, her solution for calming colonial tension, to the Comédie Française at the exact time of these reforms to the Code Noir. Her solution, the play entitled Zamor et Mirza ou l'heureux naufrage, Zamor and Mirza or the fortunate shipwreck, portrays the pardon and manumission of two slaves on an ambiguously located Indian island. Women are helpful and respected companions to their men who share the same skin color and class distinctions. They play ends with a utopian vision of the model colonial society. Enslaved and free people, whites, non-whites, women and men, live harmoniously together, organized by race and class in a familial patriarchal hierarchy. Following Rousseauian philosophy, de Gouges contradicts Monneron by insisting that the proper behavior of a father and that of the leader of an empire are one and the same. And this is where I have, la famille est le premier modèle des sociétés politiques, le chef est l'image du père, le peuple est l'image des enfants, et tous étant nés égaux libres, n'aliènent leur liberté que pour leur utilité. De Gouges was one of many abolitionist voices of the 18th century. Yet the context and content of her play and its performance provide a unique window for examining how abolitionist positions were articulated, the importance of theater to the debate, and the influence of women and feminism on abolitionist politics. This paper is divided into three sections. The first section, I examine the specifics of de Gouges' feminist and abolitionist utopia as portrayed in her play. The second section of this paper provides the historical context for the publication and performance. The third and final section, I analyze the evolution of de Gouges' abolitionism as evidenced by the three versions of her play, written and revised from 1785 to 1792.
Sorry, what does abolition mean in this thing? Abolition of what?
Slavery. I conclude that Zamori Mirza portrays an ideal colonial model that required the empowerment of women to ameliorate the condition of slaves. Though de Gouges originally sought to distance herself from other abolitionists of her day, she became increasingly outspoken about her positions as the revolution progressed. In her outspokenness, she disputed the economy over morality agenda of Monneron, but her suggestions for improving the colony never opposed the notion that changes should be based on a familial political model. The first section I've entitled De Gouges' Feminist and Abolitionist Utopia. Zamor and Mirza begins with a conversation between Zamor and his love Mirza, who were two slaves. They've escaped their master, Monsieur de Saint-Fremont, after Zamor killed an overseer to protect Mirza. They fled to an ambiguously located island for fear that the governor will not understand Zamor's behavior and instead punish him for his crime. While alone, Zamor and Mirza question the system that oppresses them. Zamor, who has been educated like a son by the governor, tells Mirza that change might come through the Enlightenment. Mirza asks simple questions about racial difference, like, why such a great difference between their kind and ours? When Zamor responds, he serves as de Gouges' abolitionist mouthpiece, repeating her theory, as stated in the epilogue, that difference only exists in color. Their loving scene is interrupted when Zamor notices a ship that has crashed ashore. He jumps in the ocean to save its passengers. Sophie and her husband Valère are on a quest to find Sophie's father. Once they shipwreck, Zamor saves them. Sophie and Valère vouch for the two slaves when representatives of the governor come to arrest them. Slaves in the colony rise up in protest. The governor, Monsieur de Saint-Fremont, laments that he must kill Zamor as an example for the good of the colony. In the last version, which is published after the 1791 slave uprisings that we understand as the beginning of the Haitian Revolution, Zamor accepts his fate and warns his fellow slaves that they should never use excessive force to free themselves. In the meantime, the governor has confessed to his wife that he had a daughter with a woman in France whom he was not allowed to marry. His wife figures out that Sophie is this daughter and rushes to let her husband know that he must save the two slaves. In a melodramatic final scene, Sophie begs the governor's pardon for the two slaves, who are then freed because everyone learns that Zamor saved the governor's daughter's life. In the 1789 and 1792 versions, so the second and third version, the play ends with a speech from the governor telling slaves that he wishes he could free them all or at least soften their plight. He then warns slaves to never lose sight of the public good. At the play's end, Zamor and Mirza prepare to marry, yet stay on as happy servants, reunited like Sophie with their father, Master, the governor. The content of de Gouges's play does not immediately appear particularly abolitionist to the modern reader. In the end, not all slaves are freed, and those who are do not leave their master. Read in connection with other plays of its period, however, the radical nature of de Gouges's play begins to show through. Jean-Baptiste Radet wrote a play entitled La Négresse ou le pouvoir de la reconnaissance, Négresse or the Power of Recognition, that was performed at the Comédie Française in 1787, just 2 years before de Gouges's. There are several similarities between Radet's play and hers. Radet's hero, Dorval, is shipwrecked on an island. He's selfishly in search of his shipwrecked father, and in the end, his father intervenes, producing a happy ending. Yet, in contrast with Zamor et Mirza, Radet's play portrays dark-skinned characters on an African island who are not enslaved. Furthermore, the female characters of his play, two African women named Zilia and Zoé, are mindlessly devoted women who attract French men through their devotion. Radet's women have little agency or intelligence. Zilia asked Dorval why he cannot sing and play the flute at the same time. The women happily dote on white men in a way that makes them extremely attractive to Dorval and his friend Frontin. At the end of Radet's play, Dorval and his father save Zilia from slavery, and they leave for France. Dorval's father suggests that he and Zilia marry, supposing that eventually people would lose their prejudice against the marriage. Zilia leaves for France, happy that tomorrow me will be white. Dorval and Zilia's union is based on a hierarchical model similar to a master-servant relationship. De Gouges, who preferred to theorize that women should be equal companions to men, avoids portraying any interracial relationships in her play. Women's equality comes, at least in part, from sharing their male partner's racial background and social status. Radet places no taboo on interracial love and even seeks to erase stereotypes against it. He does not, however, disturb the notion that women, regardless of their color, should be subservient to men. On the contrary, de Gouges gives her female characters positions of moral and political authority. Her white heroines have active roles in aiding Zamor. Madame de Saint-Frémont is as wise as her husband and in fact alerts him to the need to pardon Zamor. Sophie jumps in between Zamor and Mirza in an effort to save them. Her husband stands by and notes that his wife's heroism only endears her more to him. An enslaved woman named Coraline, who is new to the last version of the play, declares that slaves in the French colonies, quote, will not always be in chains. Moreover, Betsy, the governor's wife's slave, is the character who calls the slave trade, quote, repugnant to humanity. Furthermore, La Négresse ou le pouvoir de la reconnaissance, like many of Radet's plays, was an opera comedy. It would have been written with the primary purpose of entertainment. De Gouges's play is, on the other hand, a drama, a genre that Diderot theorized was particularly conducive to moral education. Reviews of Radet's play highlight its agreeable scenes and light ending. Indeed, its happy ending lacks the moral message that de Gouges made so central to her play's importance. Radet avoids discussing France's enslavement of Africans and makes it appear that the French, in fact, save Africans from slavery. His play reinforces the notion that there are no slaves in France and a benevolent patriarch exists to ensure this freedom. Even though both de Gouges and Radet's plays share a similar focus on France's role in helping slaves, de Gouges's play stands out from Radet's through its portrayal of active women characters, its acknowledgement that slaves did indeed exist in the French colonies, and its critique of slave owners' cruelty. In the second section of my paper, I'll talk a bit about the performance and the publication of the play. It's kind of confusing, so I've written the timeline here. So in 1785 is when the play is first accepted. 1788, it's still not performed, so she publishes it. And when she does, she publishes Réflexions sur les hommes nègres, which is a justification of her position and a complaint about it not being performed. In 1789, after the fall of the Bastille, it is performed, and she changes the name to L'Esclavage des Nègres. In 1792, she publishes it as L'Esclavage des Noirs. the story of how De Gouges' play was finally performed at the Comédie Française is a drama in and of itself. Was her play too radical for the most well-respected theater in Europe? Did other authors have similar difficulty in having their plays performed? And how was De Gouges treated as one of a tiny minority of female playwrights? In the following section, I answer these questions by exploring the history of De Gouges' fight for performance. Her play was first accepted at the Comédie in 1785. At the time, the theater was royally controlled, and its actors decided what plays were performed when. Plays were generally performed in the order in which they were received, meaning that waiting years before one's play was performed was not uncommon. After 3 years without a performance, however, authors had the right to publish their plays. If a play did not make a certain amount of money after 3 performances, it became the property of the Comédie. De Gouges' case shows that these rules could be manipulated so that the actors staged the plays that they wanted to perform. Letters located in the archives of the Comédie Française indicate that in August of 1788, her play was ninth in line to be performed. By September, it was 19th. When the play was finally performed, it was scheduled 3 times on odd days and then shut down due to a supposed lack of ticket sales. De Gouges was not the only playwright to demand more authority from the Comédie, but she did so in an unusually bold way that negatively influenced the reaction of the royal actors. The well-known author of The Marriage of Figaro, Beaumarchais, fought for more rights for actors through his Society of Dramatic Authors. De Gouges had similar feelings about the need for more authorial control, but she was not admitted to Beaumarchais' society. Her approach to demanding her rights was more overt than Beaumarchais', and I have some quotes here that she wrote in her preface and in letters to the Comédie. Her tactic was twofold. She began to complain of a double standard for male and female playwrights, at the same time that she touted the moral and urgent nature of her play's abolitionist message. De Gouges had a few things working against her. She was a woman. She was publicly not content to wait for the royally controlled theater to decide when and how to perform her play. And as the revolution progressed, she was assumed to be speaking on behalf of the Société des Amis des Noirs, the Society of the Friends of the Blacks, which was an abolitionist society. This sparked the reaction of the pro-slavery society, the Club Massiac. The royal actor Fleury confirms in his memoirs that both misogyny and an opposition to De Gouges' abolitionism were factors influencing the Royal Theater's decision to delay performance. Fleury derides De Gouges for making herself as unfeminine as possible, likely because she was a playwright and an outspoken one at that. A review of De Gouges' play's first performance declared that beards were necessary for writing a good play. Fleury confirms to the that the Comédie also proposed geographical changes in order to avoid a direct portrayal of enslaved Africans on stage. Lastly, the performance of De Gouges' play as L'Esclavage des Nègres in 1789 landed her in the middle of an intense debate between the Société des Amis des Noirs and the pro-slavery Club Massiac. De Gouges' relationship with the abolitionist society of the Friends of the Black has been a subject of debate. Gregory S. Brown, who focuses on De Gouges' self-fashionings as a playwright, writes that she was not a member. Her biographer, Olivier Blanc, insists that she was. Christopher Miller does not make a definitive statement on this issue. Yet in his memoirs, the founder of the society, Brissot, declares that De Gouges was admitted into their society. His words appear to firmly answer the question. She was certainly a member. However, she denies an association with them in 1789 And according to reprinted minutes of the society, she was not listed as in attendance at any early meetings. And I have a conversation here. The connection between de Gouges and the society is thus complex. I argue that because her letter to Monneron, which I have a section of it here, because it was published in the Chronique de Paris and was read by the society, she had some relationship with them early on, even if it was informal. Her 1792 correspondence with Brissot and changes made to her 1792 version of the play indicate that her association with the society became more official as the revolution progressed. Yet regardless of her relationship to the society, de Gouges was mocked by Monneron for speaking on their behalf through her play. And this is the letter. And obviously, Monneron gets very violent in his response to her. De Gouges was thus told that women were incapable of writing high-quality literature, and they were incapable of promoting a political agenda. She wanted to do both. For her, her literature's quality was in fact validated by its political agenda. She insisted on the moral nature of her play's message. The 1788 epilogue, Réflexions sur les hommes nègres, highlighted the abolitionist argument message of her play by blaming, quote, the unjust and powerful interest of whites for the deplorable fate of les nègres. As a preface, she republished her epistolary exchange with the actors, hoping to prove her mistreatment at their hands and insisting again that her play had to be performed. Oops, darn. Which one? There, okay. In her reflections, her argument vacillates between demanding her play's performance and lamenting the enslavement of dark-skinned people. In de Gouges' mind, performance and the ability of her play to effect change through emotionally united humans was steadfastly connected. Her notion of empathy through observation is related to Diderot's theory of theater. She wanted to have her play performed because its effect was thought to be exponentially greater through performance. Seeing a play would incite more emotion and therefore more sympathy in de Gouges' audience. According to Lynn Festa's work on figures of empire in 18th century France, sentimental sympathy, quote, affirms humanity based on an ability to excite or experience emotion. Performance and de Gouges' political message go hand in hand. Several scholars have analyzed the complicated way in which de Gouges fought to have her play performed. Brown, a specialist in 18th century theater, emphasizes the perhaps opportunistic nature of de Gouges' increasingly public abolitionism. Miller highlights the influence of the complex workings of the French Atlantic Triangle in the decision to put off the play's performance. Marie-Pierre Le Hire stresses the influence of misogyny in the rejection of her play's performance, of her play. All these factors had influence on her play and its demise. The author was not reserved in her demands to have her play performed, and she faced the misogyny of actors like Fleury, and in the midst of the heated abolitionist debates of the 1780s, actors hesitated to perform a play that, though not explicitly about any one French colony in particular, discussed slavery more openly than most plays that preceded it. Despite the many factors working against her, she was driven by a resolute belief in the absurdity of the misogynist arguments of actors and observers who tried to devalue her work, and in the importance of theater to moral and political action. And this last section I've entitled The Evolution of Her Abolitionism. De Gouges fought with the Comédie Française for almost 5 years before Zamor and Mirza was performed as L'Esclavage des Nègres in 1789. 3 years after its performance, she published a third and final version of the play, even though previous rules dictated that her play had become property of the Comédie. In 1791, she submitted another play to the Comédie that's now lost. A lot of her papers were burned after her death, that was also on the subject of the slave trade. It was rejected outright. From the mid-1780s until the year before her death, de Gouges' interest in improving the lot of slaves in the colonies never waned. The final version of Deguja's play shows that the author became increasingly specific about her focus on Caribbean slavery. The play takes place on an island that is first in Les Indes Orientales, the East Indies, and then afterwards simply in the Indies. She moves from east to west, making a direct reference to the French West Indies possible. Additionally, though there is a consistent confusion that is not unusual for its time between the words Indien and Nègre, throughout the play's three versions, she adds a direct reference to the Middle Passage in the 1792 version. Though she suggests that her play incited the formation of the abolitionist society because its first publication preceded the society's first meeting, it is more likely that Deguja received important information about the African slave trade from the society that in turn influenced later versions of her play. By the time Deguja's play was performed, the society was circulating images of slave ships provided by English abolitionists. Her late admission to the society would explain why later versions of her play are more precise in their portrayal of the colonial. Deguja's play, though consistently allegorical through its ambiguity, became increasingly specific about the connections between France, Africa, and the Caribbean, as other French revolutionaries did. Following a trend among abolitionists, she decided to publish the last version of her play as L'Esclavage des Noirs, so the slavery of blacks. She used the word noir. As Peabody explains, the word nègre had two meanings in late 18th century France. It meant both dark-skinned and enslaved. Deguja refers to the play as L'Esclavage des Noirs as early as 1790, but she continues to use nègre in the text, which could be due to the double definition of the word nègre. Zamor and Mirza are enslaved and therefore nègre. Nonetheless, during the early years of the revolution, the word nègre became increasingly taboo, and it appears that through her title change, Deguja recognized this trend. According to Dubois' research on racial markers in the revolutionary French Antilles, quote, although it is not possible to track a precise and consistent correlation between the use of these terms and the political positions of those who use them, in general, Republican defenders of emancipation tended to use the word noir. Deguja's use of the word noir in the title of her play would have associated her with the abolitionist movement. Through language, she began to oppose the double definition of the word nègre that made skin color synonymous with enslavement. By changing the title from L'Esclavage des Nègres to L'Esclavage des Noirs, she could insist upon a difference of skin color rather than status. Her final title makes her political position obvious. Olympe de Gouges boldly and hopefully declared that si jamais l'humanité triomphera la barbarie dans les colonies, mon nom sera peut-être vénéré dans ces climats. By insisting on the humanity of both non-whites and women, Deguja opposed what she considered the barbaric practice of slavery in the colonies in increasingly explicit ways. The last version of her play was published 6 months after what we now know as the beginning of the Haitian Revolution. It was a time when slaves controlled much of the northern province of Saint-Domingue. The violence of the revolts led Deguja to chastise slaves. Her play, in all its forms, insists on the unity of the French colonial family. Susan Maslin accurately describes the goal of late 18th century drama as one that could, quote, produce plays capable of instructing fathers, mothers, and children how best to fulfill their familial responsibilities and in so doing find happiness, end quote. The family of Deguja's drama is the larger French empire, and her instructions for fathers, mothers, and children changed the rules for proper familial colonial behavior. Thank you.